So thank you guys for coming. Just really briefly, my name is Naval Wright. I'll tell you a little bit about my background later, but really the purpose of this session is to kind of give you guys an overview of why I think this is a significant problem that needs to be tackled. It's one of those problems, I call it the biggest problem that no one talks about, and there's a lot of reasons behind it. So hopefully after the end of this session, you'll have questions, you'll have some insight, and you'll kind of see what I see in regards to this issue. So the title of this presentation is Why Should You Care? Right? There's an important issue out there. You've heard the word digital divide before, but at the end of the day, I don't presuppose that anyone has a big earnest interest in it, so I want to explain why you should care. So we live in an internet economy. You know, I brought some stats with me from the government's Commerce Department website that according to the census last year, domestic online transactions total $3.7 trillion. International transactions total $10 trillion. That's huge economic shift. These are all online transactions. By the estimate, you know, American jobs related to the internet contributed to an estimated $300 billion of economic activity to U.S. gross domestic product in 2009. Digital literacy is necessary for today's jobs. 96% of working Americans use new communication technologies as part of their daily life. 62% of working Americans use the internet as an integral part of their jobs. American jobs related to the internet contributed to $300 billion of economic activity. Between 1998 and 2008, the number of domestic IT jobs grew by 26%, four times faster than the U.S. employment rate by whole, and IT employment is expected to grow by another 22%. Now, you put that in contrast to the unemployment concerns we've had over the last 2 years, you see that there's a fundamental shift in opportunity there. According to one estimate, advertising-supported internet services directly or indirectly employed 3 million Americans. 1.2 million of those jobs didn't exist 2 decades ago. Digital literacy is necessary for everyday life. Not only is it creating jobs, but everything from applying to a job, finding information about healthcare, educating yourself, finding information about educational opportunities, more and more of these services are being connected to online. And having access to those services change your quality of life. Now, in terms of the broadband adoption gap, they've all said that there's no single solution to this problem, but if you look at what I have highlighted in red, you kind of see where the digital divide has started to focus on. That digital literacy has become the primary challenge in terms of digital opportunity and the digital divide. If you all remember during the Clinton era, when the word digital divide first came out, it was all about access to the internet in general. It was about providing access to rural areas and in inner cities where it hadn't been connected. I think we all can firmly believe a lot of those problems have been solved. The new problem is that even though the opportunities are there, people aren't connecting to them, and this is a valid reason for it. So looking at those numbers, I want to talk a little bit about how the country is changing. So there's this concept of the new mainstream. And the new mainstream is an emerging term meant to describe the ethnic demographic shift in U.S. consumer landscape, as well as the psychographic shift in ethnic norms. So what does that mean in layman's terms? That our ethnic makeup is changing in the United States. So population growth in the last 10 years was almost all ethnic. This is a significant shift in our U.S. population over the last couple of decades. 82%. Population by ethnicity, I want to give you a comparison. This is what it looked like in 1980, and this is what, that slide didn't work. Let's see. Oh, you guys can't see it there. It's there. I'll read it to you. So in 1980, we had 2% Asian, we had 6% Hispanic, 11% black, 3% other, and the rest white Americans. In 2010, it was 12% black, 16% Hispanic, 5% Asian, and 3% other. So you've seen changes in those key areas. And then lastly, here's the ethnic percentage of 18 to 24-year-olds in the United States today. So 2040, why is 2040 important? 2040 is important because the census has projected that people of color will be the majority in the United States in the year 2040. That number is actually accelerated. Now they're projecting it may be as early as 2020. The challenge with that is that the current minority achievement gap will not have closed by then, given current activity and standards. So what does that mean? That means that we'll have a United States that's primarily filled with people of color who may be uneducated, underemployed, have less access to technology, and not help grow the economic landscape of our country. So when I talk about this, it's not a charity issue. I call it an opportunity issue that affects everybody. So we're in 2013. Let's see where we are. Currently, only 1% of internet companies were founded by African Americans, given the internet landscape. So that's for every Twitter, Facebook, the thousands of other internet companies. 1% of those were founded by African Americans.
Including startups?
All startups, all internet-based startups, yep, 1%. Nearly one-third of U.S. households lack broadband service, given that we've already talked about that it's available almost everywhere. The two most common cited reasons for not having broadband internet access in the home are perceived as being not needed, 46%, or too expensive, 25%. So it's no longer an issue of cost. It's that there's a large portion of our demographic that just don't see the importance of the internet. And the notable disparities become among demographic groups are people with low incomes, disabilities, seniors, minorities, the less educated, non-family households, and the non-employed tend to lag behind other groups in home broadband use. So if you think about the numbers I just showed you, that we're going towards an America that's primarily minority, and we have an America where minorities are disconnected from the most economically thriving source of income in our country right now. And I can share that with you. Yeah, I don't have it in the deck, but I can share it with you.
Is there any correlation?
Yeah, so really the correlation, I think the ranges were between the parents in those households are ranges between the age of 38 and 50. And just from personal anecdotal experience, I can tell you in minority households, we have what I call kind of a generational lag, right? So even if children are getting exposed to technology at school or other places, they're going back to home environments where they're not comfortable with technology. And also based on current their economic climate, they don't perceive that that's the quickest way to achieve a living. So you could have the brightest kid in the world, but if they're not being promoted to use that technology at home, there's a disconnect. So really shiftly kind of quicking to tell you about myself. So I've been involved in technology for about 20 years. I spent 6 years as the CTO of Black Entertainment Television. I started an internet company with Russell Simmons. I currently now am the CTO of Radio One, which is the largest African-American radio network in the country. And I've been involved in this space. And recently, I was involved in a documentary on CNN with Soledad O'Brien that focused on the lack of minorities in technology. But the real reason I put this up is to show you guys all the cool people I get to hang out with. But another thing is, technology takes me everywhere. You know, everywhere I go, the people I've connected with, the relationships I've had, have been based on my knowledge of technology. The reason why I show these pictures is because it's a shift from why you would think I would be connected to this environment in the first place, and why mainstream America would think I would be connected to this environment. But again, I still wanted to show you guys more cool pictures of the people that I hang out with. But, you know, as excited as I am about the things I've done, the people I've met, the relationships I have, I more importantly reflect on this issue about where I'm from. So I was born and raised in Trenton, New Jersey. I'm the first member of my family to graduate from college. That is actually a picture of the house where I grew up in on Stuyvesant Avenue in Trenton, New Jersey. I show this to basically say a couple things. One is, if you would have told the skinny, bigger kid that walked out of that room that he would have been involved in the things he's been in, worked at the companies he's worked at, had the opportunities he's had, he wouldn't believe you. And if you don't believe me, that's what that guy used to look like. So the other premise of this is I show this slide a lot when I speak to teens and youth groups around the country, those first three sequences of slides, for that very reason, because I want them to see that where you go is not limited from where you come from. And really what I wanted them to see is I'm a living example of what I say about closing the divide, that I've used technology as a tool to come from out of that house to all the things that I've done on the right-hand side. So that's what I want to talk to you today about, closing the divide. And if you notice, I didn't just say close the digital divide, because I think it's more expansive than that. There's one thing I talk about is called closing the perspective divide, because I firmly believe in this new digital divide, we have what I call a perspective problem. So here's a visual example. So I firmly believe that this is the perspective of everyone in this room. right? You believe that there is a lot of opportunity in the United States. You know that if you have a problem, you pretty much know where to go solve it. You know that technology is part of your lives, even if you don't want it to be. You know how to use it. But in contrast, in most urban areas, this is their perspective. It's only focused on what's directly in front of them. It's focused on how do they get through the next week, how do they achieve, how do they survive. And what that means is there can be opportunities to the left or right of them, but they never see them. That's the new digital divide. But I go back to the question, why should you care? You should care because, unfortunately, I look in the makeup of this room, their internet is not our internet. You know, adults are adopting broadband at a slower pace. Most of us can remember pre-internet time. Our online personas consist of maybe we'll have a Facebook account, we'll have a LinkedIn account because we're professionals, and we might have decided to get on Twitter, but we probably haven't sent a tweet. But today's youth are digital natives. 30% of all teen girls blog, 20% of boys. 54% of Wired girls post photos, unfortunately, for parents, and 40% of boys. 39% of online teens share their own artistic creations online. 33% work on web pages or blogs. 29% remix content. And over 18 million youth are members of this demographic. So they're on YouTube. They're surfing Google. They're on Facebook. They're on Twitter. They have a WordPress blog. They're watching videos on Hulu. They have a Tumblr blog because they want to do the quick things that they don't want to do in their WordPress blog. They're on Fancast looking at videos. And they're on Twitter. Some of them have multiple accounts on Twitter. Now, the reason why this is important is because technology is moving faster today than ever. So I'm going to give you guys a little timeline. Before 1998, there was no Google. Before 2002, there was no LinkedIn. Before 2004, there was no Facebook. No poking before 2004. Before 2006, no Twitter. OMG, LOL, no Twitter. Before 2007, there was no Words with Friends. Also before 2007, there was no iPhone. Think about how far you need to walk before you see another person with an iPhone. 2007. 2009, there was no Square. Now, a lot of people don't know about Square, but I talk a lot about Square because I think it's one of those companies that could transform the minority business landscape. So there's a metric. I think the numbers around 75% of African-American-owned businesses are cash only. They're cash only because they can't qualify for a merchant account. And what Square does is it's a little plastic device you plug into your iPhone, Android device, iPad, BlackBerry. If you have a BlackBerry, you're still taking cash, but every other phone. And then within 2 minutes, you're taking credit card transactions. No merchant account, you're ready to go. So I think this is one of those things that single-handedly could change the face of minority-owned business, but I can guarantee you over 50% of them don't even know it exists. And just a note, Square does, I think the last time I checked, 40 million in transactions a day. Angry Birds, 2010. Angry Birds recorded a net revenue of $350 million last year. Think about that the next time you pull back on that little slingshot on your phone. Last but not least, Instagram. Started by two guys in 2010, sold to Facebook for $1 billion a year and a half later. I show you this to show you that the world is moving at an accelerated pace. And if you think back to all the challenges I've shown you so far, that means for every day that we don't make changes, they're further disconnected from that opportunity. So we have a broadband gap between youth and minority youth. Unfortunately, a lot of minority youth don't know their way around the computer. They're not aware of what's available for them online. They only connect with products when they become mainstream. And they'd be more likely to buy a game console than they are to buy a computer. Now, why is that? Again, I think it's because we have a perception problem. Now, this perception problem is really what the world has perceived minorities' places in the world of technology, minority and women. And basically, that perception is that African Americans and Hispanics are perceived just to not be good in technology. We can use it, but we're just not good at it. But because of that, technology is widening the education gap every day. Because if you have a perceived notion that a demographic group isn't good at something, you're less inclined to push them down those paths. But I can tell you that if your child is not technology literate, they will be unemployable in today's economy. I have a term that I use. It's called statistical racism. The reason why I use that term is because if you look at statistics today, they would clearly say that minorities have no place in the world of technology. But we know through monumental achievements through technology and people who have done so in trendsetters that that's not true. We also know that most demographics that jump into a certain area of success, the statistics before don't show why they should be there. But this is even more prevalent today because the system has actually accepted this as a norm and no one's willing to change it. Here in the Valley, you know, since we're in Silicon Valley, it's good to mention, there's these things called accelerators, right? Y Combinator is a big one, Techstars. And basically what they do is the companies apply, they give them some seed capital, they give them some mentorship, and they introduce them to the investment community. So they basically accelerate the process from idea on the napkin to getting funded. Now, if you talk to a lot of these companies, they will say, we are open to everyone. We're open to women, we're open to minorities, whoever has a great idea. The challenge is that the prerequisite in that is that the people who come to these programs already have a base set of skills in which to interact with these programs. But if this demographic is already lagging and falling behind, they're not getting the base set of skills. If they're not getting the base set of skills, there's no visual examples of them for them to feed off of, for them to say, oh, I need to go get those skills. And if these open environments aren't going into the environments where they are and teaching them the skills, you have a perpetual cycle that creates that gap. And I just want to show you an example of how this prevails in the media. So this is a photo from a New York Times, Sunday New York Times article that talked about a school that was adopting technology in a big way. But I don't know about you, but she looks really confused. But this was in a Sunday New York Times full page spread about technology. You know, and I bring this up because these are subtle terms that continue that stereotype that, hey, if you're reading this and you've never come in contact with a young African American and you think this is your perception, in your mind, that subtext tells you that they don't want to have anything to do with technology. Now, crazily enough, this same photo was in the same article about two paragraphs down. That's the perception problem that we have to change. We have to make it so that minorities become creators and not just consumers. Because the world set up today, they consume it at a rapid pace. You'll see numbers that tell you that African Americans are over-indexing on mobile devices, but you won't see numbers that say minorities are creating technology on those devices. Again, perspective. So when we talk about closing the divide, we talk about closing an opportunity divide. So why is that so important? It's important because minorities are losing. This is an unemployment chart by race. African Americans hover between 14 and 60% at any given time. Hispanics hover around 11, 12, when mainstream white America hovers around 7, 8%. Even when you have the best economic times for mainstream America, African Americans and Hispanics, unemployment rate is considerably higher. The reason why this is an opportunity is because if we flip that, if we incorporated more of them into that lower number, we have the opportunity to empower a whole generation. We can change neighborhoods, we can change families, just by getting these people into a role of prosperity. We can create economic parity for people who have lost hope of the possibility of opportunities for them. We can give birth to new ideas that bring about new change. I have a big belief that diverse thought brings about diverse solutions, right? We don't need another Twitter client. We don't need another social network. We need people who are solving real problems, who are coming from problems that haven't been solved yet. So why is this so important? Because I actually believe the solution is right here. We're talking about a high growth economy. I'll tell you a story. I was at Google, been at Google in New York a couple times and here as well, and they have signs on the wall. The signs say, who did you refer today? They try to have a minimum of 3 referrals per employee per week because they have so many jobs that they cannot fill. In Charlotte, North Carolina, the unemployment rate currently hovers around 15%. So logic would dictate, go to Charlotte, North Carolina, train those people in the jobs that you fill and fill those jobs. That's not happening. But we do have available and trainable workforce. We have people who have been unemployed for over a year, year and a half. right? And if you understand the systemic cycle in inner city neighborhoods, once I'm unemployed for a year, 2 years, I don't think I'm ever going to be employed. So I start looking at other options. It's the reason why you have cities like Chicago that are knee-deep in violence. There's no opportunity there. And again, diverse thought brings diverse solutions. So like I said, the numbers will tell you that adoption is up, activity is higher, but there's still an issue. Minorities are not adopting the key areas at the same pace as the rest of America. And African Americans' broadband growth is lower than average for the past 3 years. But again, why should you care? Well, let's think about imagining the possibilities for our youth. The beauty is, in this world, entrepreneurship can start at any age. This is a photo from a Fast Company article that was published last year called The Apprentices. And they profiled five kids ages 13 to 18 who had all built apps in their spare time. And the big thing to note about this is each one of them made an average of $60,000 a year from their app that they built in their spare time. Some of the comments were, hey, it was really fun to do. It was great to see my game and see people buy it. Hey, I think I might build another one. Now, I ask you to contrast that with if this happened in inner city Chicago. I'll stay in Chicago. That a kid in inner city Chicago can make $60,000 a year and not only change the economic makeup of his life, but his entire family's life. He could go on to create multiple apps and employ his friends and employ people in the city that otherwise were unemployable. We're talking about creating ecosystems. I'll tell you another story. I blog, so I decided to write a blog about what it takes to build an iPhone app. So I did a Google search. Everything starts with a Google search. And I found on iTunes, there's a class taught at Stanford that's offered for free on iTunes. Every year it's updated. So you can take the same class that's taught at Stanford on how to build iPhone apps. The guys from Apple, they download everything free of charge. I also found out that 30 universities offer courses on Apple for free. So then I went to my local library. I even found a couple books on how to build iPhone apps. So I said, all right, I have all this information. Well, how much does it cost? I looked online in the Apple developer site, and it cost $99 to become an Apple developer. So you relate that to starting a restaurant, laundromat, any brick-and-mortar business. The barrier is that low. So if the barrier is that low and the opportunities are this high, the logic would ask you, why don't we have more people doing it, especially more people who have been out of work and more people in those situations. The other thing it does is it allows you to follow your passion to your career. I probably haven't worked in 15 years because everything I've done has been something I've enjoyed to do. And if you can go into environments where people only think that the only thing they can do is what they have to do and tell them that if they have a passion in something, there's a tool that can enable them and accelerate that, imagine the creativity, imagine the economic stimulus that we would have in those environments. Look at the places they can work. Here's a guy sliding down a slide at Google, heading to a meeting. There's a couple other people sitting on bouncy balls, hanging out, coding. At Google, there's 7 cafeterias that are open 24 hours a day from Monday through Friday in New York City. There's free dry cleaning. There's $5 an hour masseuses. And you get paid a 6-figure salary. I've often said that if we take kids from any inner city, let them go through Facebook, Google, Zynga, and at the end tell them, hey, all you have to do is learn how to program, and we stop at the library will be empty by the time they leave. And the reason is because they will have a visual representation of what success looks like. Right now, the gulf is intangible to them because they don't see anyone who looks like them in those environments. That's what has to change. And one of the most important things is today the barriers are lower than they've ever been to get involved in the technology space. I've named iTunes before. There's another site that's free called CodeYear that lets you learn how to be a web developer over the course of a year just by taking classes. Khan Academy has revolutionized education. Most minority students don't even know about it. Team Treehouse, $25 a month, you can learn how to build iPhone apps, web developer, computer literacy, anything you want. These are not astronomically costing solutions. These are things that are readily available that people can be connected to right now. Students are starting companies while in school. I tell college kids it's the best time to start a company because someone else is paying all your expenses. They should be starting companies right now. But we have to bridge and connect them to these opportunities. you know, people are coming at it multiple ways. So Code 2040 is an organization a friend of mine, Tristan Walker, started, where he's getting more minorities involved in internships at Silicon Valley and New York startups. The New Me Accelerator is another program which I've mentored in, which is part of the CNN special, where they're bringing people of color and women to Silicon Valley to help accelerate their companies in environments that otherwise they weren't able to get access to. So I show this to you that the new digital divide is in this world, there's all these resources. There's free resources, there's low-cost resources, there's programs. And on this side, there's a whole demographic that has no idea they exist. And more importantly, they think it's not important to know that they exist. And the world's not doing anything to change that fact. So that's not going to change anytime soon. So I personally decided to do something. So about a year ago, I came up with the idea of something I call the Closed Divide Project, which is really focused on bridging that gap. I looked at my life. I looked at the networks I have. I looked at the opportunities I have, the things I come in contact with. And I decided to go into the world and spread that message to as many people as humanly possible. I came up with this concept called the 10,000, because I made it my goal in 2012 to connect to 10,000 people. And the reason being is that if I connect to 10,000 people, and each one of those people connect to one person, that exponentially grows, then we have millions of people who have some of the knowledge that we talked about today, which just scratches the surface of the opportunity. Really, in the first step, to create ecosystems in places that don't exist right now, so that these conversations are being had, so that people are thinking, hey, I have a problem or issue, they know the look, that they're a Google search away. The goal in all of this is to achieve what I call a light bulb moment. And what a light bulb moment is when you show something to someone and that light bulb goes off and they can't think about it the same way anymore. That the next time that they come into a problem, they remember that and say, hey, you know what, if I investigate, there's a solution there. I believe that simple light bulb moment can change the lives of thousands, if not millions, of people because it makes them think differently. It lets them see that wide perspective that we're all so fortunate to have. And at the end of the day, who are we talking about? We're talking about people. We're talking about people who are in this world looking for opportunities in places that haven't been shown to them. We're talking about people who have ideas that could change the makeup of this country, that could create economic stimulus. We're talking about people who have creativity in ways that we haven't even begun to think of. We're talking about people who can create programs, applications, that can make your lives easier every day. Again, like I said, this is not a charity issue, it's an opportunity issue. We're talking about winning. We're talking about closing the divide. So when I think about this audience, this conference, where so many people who are so focused on changing the world in big ways, I can't think of a bigger problem. Because it connects with every aspect of your lives. In education, if we can train teachers to incorporate technology into their everyday lives, then you have a next generation of people who think of technology as commonplace, who think that it's part of everything that they do. Another story, my son goes to a private school, and his teacher uses a photo bucket account, which costs about 10 bucks a month, and her assistant take a photograph of every assignment, and they take a video on their phone of every time they speak in front of class. So when we go to parent-teacher conferences, they have a chronological view of my son's development, much more impactful than just telling me how he did. Now, again, take that and put it in an inner city school where you have a parent who can never make it to parent-teacher conference, who just is working too much and never has a visual representation of their child's achievement. That simple process would allow them to have an empathic relationship with how their kid's doing and have a different vantage point on why they want their kid to be educated and what's important to their kid. They see the light in their kid's eyes when they look at one subject versus the other. There's these small things. It's not huge undertakings. It's a perspective change that we can do. There's another story. You'll see I have a lot of stories. There's another story. There was a person who lived in an inner city, hadn't worked for about 6 months. They heard that the Walmart was hiring. So they took the last little bit of money, rode the bus for about 5 miles to the Walmart, only to get there and they say they only take applications online. Those type of stories happen every day. And that's a simple knowledge thing that we can do and we can change to give people opportunities. I'll give you a personal story. Last night, I was able to rent a car in San Francisco for $7 a day on Priceline from my phone. I rented it 10 minutes before I got off the plane. There's 20 other people in that line who paid full price for their cars. That's the disconnect that happens every day. Now, that's minor. I could have paid full price, but that's the disconnect that happens in the inner city every day, that we have access and knowledge to opportunities, resources, that people right next to us are working 10 times harder and don't have access to that simple piece of information that can make their lives easier. I don't know what I did. Oh, I know what I did. So in closing, before I take some questions, I just want you to think about any aspect of life that you're in and think about how those nuances can change that life. So just before we open it up to questions and let you guys know how to contact me, my personal blog is NavarroWright.com. The initiative is at closethedivide4.me. I'm on Twitter at NavarroWright. And the last URL was actually selected by Verizon to be a part of their 2013 Celebrate Their Stories campaign, which is allowing me to talk nationally about the Close the Divide initiative. So that's there now and going nationally on TV next week. And just lastly, if any of you are digitally inclined, I ask you to send out that tweet. If you feel you've had a light bulb moment while you've been in this conversation, to let the world know you had a light bulb moment with me, and you're now officially part of the 10,000. So thank you. I'd like to open it up for questions if people have any. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yes, sir.
Thank you for this. I'm struck by the photo that you showed from the New York Times. It made me think about an event I attended last summer. It was the Games for Change conference. And there was a school, there was a girls' school in Brooklyn, I believe, where there was a technology focus for these young girls. And I was wondering if that was the school, because while I was sitting there in their exhibit hall, a woman from a private school that was in upstate New York had gone over there. She was so impressed with the idea, the promise of what these girls were doing, she offered scholarships to the school for their graduating class.
Right.
Because they just recognized there was this dearth of, you know, the fact that there are a lot of more women are involved in technology, but they don't, it's not seen that way. So they were given this opportunity, these young African-American girls, to get engaged and make sure they had another way along that pathway. So as you're experiencing this and telling the story and telling and really trying to close the divide, what are you seeing as some of the challenges beyond what's happening within the homes? What are you seeing where the challenges are socially? Like, if you can speak a little bit to what you spoke to.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's so many levels to it, right? I think, you know, minorities have it hard, women have it hard, plus one, minority women, exponentially times 10, right? Because, again, those perceptions are real. There is a perception in the United States that there are only certain demographics that can succeed in technology, right? And that permeates, right? It permeates here in the Valley. You know, there's constant panels and conversations about getting more women. People don't want to touch the minority issue is because no one wants to be labeled as being, you know, exclusive, because if they feel like if they make a statement, they will be. But that's environmental to Silicon Valley. What I see out there, it's kind of twofold, right? I talk a lot about visual representations. I'll give you an example. One of the things I do as part of the Close the Divide project is I do these things called Divide Talks. And basically what they are is I get people together on Google Hangouts, and I put out a message on Twitter. I'm looking for women and people of color who are into technology, who use technology, who have started companies. And I started doing that so that I could create a library of visual representation of people in the space. So that at some point, some teacher could go and show to their kids, here's a conversation with, one day I had six women, all who had started internet companies, who were versed in technology, having a dialogue at 9:30 Eastern on a Tuesday night, right? And to me, that's the visual representation they need to see. Because it's one thing for us to go into a room and say, hey, you guys should learn technology. And most kids will say, why? They're like, why? I just watched TV, and I think if I get on TV, I could become rich faster than, you know, building something. I'll give you another one. When I first start a presentation to kids, I start off the same way. I say, there was a guy in a college dorm room eating free college food, using free software, and within 5 years, he's worth more than Puffy, Jay-Z, Russell Simmons, and every other entertainer you can throw on the bus. I can tell you that 95% of the time, from speaking to a minority audience, they have no idea who I'm talking about. And when I ask how many of you guys have a Facebook account, they all raise their hand. Like, that's the disconnect. That how you can use something every day and not even rationalize the thought that you could possibly build something similar, or rationalize or want to know who built it, right? And the Facebook economy is unique because there is a small barrier to you actually creating applications for Facebook. Zynga, which is a $1 billion public company, started on Facebook. You know, I mean, these it doesn't even rationalize. I mean, I can tell you guys, I've had some of the most painful conversations in inner city schools where kids don't even rationalize that. I mean, if I have kids coming saying, I want to be a rapper, I want to be a poet, I want to make movies, because that's the only visual representation they have of success. And we have to change that. That's the biggest problem. And that's my biggest beef with STEM education programs, because STEM education programs do this very generic, where you should learn science and engineering and technology. I go in a room and say, look, here's five teenagers that are the same age as you. They're making $60,000 a year. Kids line up. How can I make $60,000 a year? Like, it's that simple, because in their environment, it's about, how do I get out of the situation I'm in right now? How do I help my family who's struggling? It's a worker mentality. But the reality is, if you attach that to this, then the work becomes exponentially fruitful for everybody else.
Do you have a sense of what the kind of undercurrents of the psychology is? I mean, this is a very general question, but in homes where people feel like they don't want the internet in their homes, what it is about the internet?
Yeah, they just don't think it's important.
But I think a lot of people are wary of the internet.
Well, I think, and let me speak, I think specifically in minority homes, the challenge is, like I said, it's generational, right? Like I said, we're all digital immigrants, we're not digital natives. But there are some people who just are ignorant to it. Like, they literally don't have a comfortable understanding of, like, it sounds crazy in 2013, but there are people who don't know what the internet is.
So do you think they find it kind of threatening to the structure they already have in place at home that they're familiar with?
I think threatening is too strong of a term. I just think in the hierarchical priority of their lives, it doesn't add value. It doesn't add value. Cable adds value because I can watch the news, and after I had a hard day, I can watch something funny. Right? The telephone has value because I can call my friends. But here's the disconnect. What they don't understand, especially in those environments, that internet connection could probably save you money on everything else you're spending, right? You spend $150 on the cable bill when for $37 you could have Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and another service and watch things whenever you want.
What's that about? That's why there's something about that disconnect that has a kind of psychological ring to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has nothing to do with intelligence. It's exposure. It's exposure. I mean, tell me the last time you saw a Skype van in an inner city project telling people about Skype. Like, it just doesn't happen, right? So if you're not in an environment where people are having conversations around topics, you're ignorant to it. You just don't. It's not even about negativity. You just don't know. And if you're looking at a scenario where you're just trying to pay your bills, if someone's not showing you a good, tangible way of why that's valuable, and to me, the conversations are simple. Your phone bill is $100 a month. Get rid of it, use Skype to call your cousins in California, you save $100, right? Hey, did you know half the movies you watch for $100 a month on cable or on Netflix for $8 a month? They're very simple conversations that improve quality of life, but no one's having them, right? If I were a broadband company, I would come up with a whole sales plan to articulate why the value is to certain demographic groups. The problem is, but that no one sees that as immediate revenue value proposition, so they don't do it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just want to chime in on that. Before I came to the North Family Foundation, I was working in for an organization called One Community, which was tackling the digital divide. So a lot of these issues I was dealing with, we were training people 18 years and older how to use the computer in meaningful ways. And some of the challenges I found that people would get excited about the Netflix tool, they get excited about the Google Voice tool and being able to save on the phone. But the next piece was it actually going to their homes. You know, they would come to this technology center, we would train them, they get excited, but there was still that unease because they hadn't seen it in their environment. They had only seen it in this computer lab. So I think, like you said, that Skype truck showing up in the community would be a huge difference, or actually, you know, and one another thing, the broadband companies weren't working with us. We would go to Time Warner, we'd go to Windstream and say, hey, we're working with a low-income population, can you look, offer us a lower rate of your broadband? And most of the time, they knew there was a monopoly, they had no choice but to come to them. So I'm interested here, if you worked out any relationships with broadband providers, as well as some of these going into the community and actually doing installations.
I've definitely had conversations with them. I think the challenges are the challenges you're facing, which are bottom line challenges. Like, you know, almost every broadband company has some program that they say is helping kind of educate that audience, but they're really not looking at it from a true needs-based perspective. Like, for example, in terms of the Close the Divide project, I look at it in a couple phases. The first phase is just general awareness. It's just putting, getting in front of as many people, having these conversations, so they go off and have those conversations. That's phase one. The second one is the visual representation piece, right? Is launching the site, having those videos there, having people there, and just having a list of those resources. Like, you know, I rattled off about 10. I can rattle off sites and services, whatever problem you tell me, but today there's no place that you can direct people to, and that was part of the thing that came out of it. I was do talks, and people were like, well, where did I go to find this stuff? And I couldn't tell them except just search Google. Then the last piece is, I believe, you know, we talked earlier in a panel about the whole concept of an ecosystem, right? The reason why Silicon Valley is so prevalent is because they've built an ecosystem over time, right? You know, you can come here with technology skills, you can find other people with similar skills, you can find a job, you can get the training to start your own company, you find your own company, you hire people, rinse, repeat, right? But in challenging those ecosystems, they're always connected to other cities that are right here that could benefit from those ecosystems that never get them. Here it's San Jose, it's Oakland, directly here, but they don't permeate out, right? New York's starting to happen. It's in New York, it's in Brooklyn, it's not in Queens, it's not in the Bronx, right? They kind of circle there. I believe the true opportunity is creating ecosystems in places that don't have any, right? I'll stay on Chicago because I've been saying it a lot. But imagine if you created that ecosystem in Chicago. And just to give you tactically, I've had a conversation, there's a program in Silicon Valley called Dev Bootcamp. And for $11,000, 9-week program, you come out as a Ruby on Rails developer, and they help you find a job, right? When I found it, on the back page, it said, we are desperately looking for women and minorities, mm-hmm. so much so that we will offer a $500 scholarship to get in. I called the guy and said, a $500 scholarship off $11,000 is like a $2 scholarship to people who don't have the money. So now I'm working with him to try and find people to sponsor people to go through that program. And he also told me he's opening up one in Chicago in April. So I immediately connected him with a pastor I knew in Chicago that has a very large church. And we're going to find local businessmen and start to do that pilot program so that Brian says she may cover it. So trying to build those awareness. Because at the end of the day, before, remember, I talked about statistical racism. We need statistical data that shows you can take someone out of this environment, train them in those skills. Because that's the argument you will get. Well, I don't know if that's, you know, people have tried that, but they haven't tried it with the same kind of focus, and they've kind of sprayed it and said, hey, who grabs it? You have to go and articulate it to people the right way.
What do you see? Because, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think the problem is more acute in the inner city and among minority communities. But, of course, this is also a problem with STEM, as you pointed out, is a problem we face as a country.
Absolutely.
You know, people are not looking at that as, you know, it's pervasive in all communities that look to the Kardashians rather than, you know, the Bill Gates. So you talk about your overarching strategy, but tactically, how do you see scaling, you know, one man's goal here? Because you're an extremely effective communicator for all of this. It makes perfect sense, and you're also, at the same time, the perfect person to go to these communities and say, here's why, you know, you're an incredibly powerful representative for what you're trying to do. So how, and you can network these individual opportunities, like to Chicago, et cetera. How do you see scaling this? You know, you talked about the STEM, you're not a fan of STEM programs because they talk about this like almost from a moral perspective. It is a good thing, you know,
right,
to do this. How, what is your STEM program alternative to get to this particular community
yep.
in a scalable manner?
No, great question. So I look at it as, you know, creating an ecosystem one city at a time. And I think there's three core elements in any given city that can be used to create that ecosystem. One is local colleges. The second one is local small businesses. And the third one is local faith-based organizations, right? Because you can create an ecosystem where they mutually benefit each other, right? Let's say I had Google as a partner. So I could go into a local college and say, hey, we're going to train you in these skills. We're going to give you access to Google products. But in return, we're going to partner you with a small business, and you're going to have to help them get current in technology, help them get everything online, et cetera. We tell the small business, hey, we're going to give you services for free, but in exchange, you have to allow this person to come help you and help educate you. And at the end of the day, you have to make an agreement to hire someone to focus on that over a period of time. You go to the faith-based organization and say, hey, we're going to give you access to these services and train your people, but you have to provide services to those people at the same time. So you have an ecosystem of those three core areas starting to permeate that idea in the environment, right? You educate those groups, and then they educate each other, because that's really what's missing, right? What's missing is I can be, you know, the smartest kid in the world. I can have the best idea in the world. If I have no one to tell it to, if I have no one to say, okay, do X, Y, and Z, it's a dead idea, right? That's really what, you know, I'm a digital hype man, for lack of a better term. You're right. I believe if I can get you in the room, I can get you to see the value in what I'm saying. So that's not the hard part. The hard part is continuing. I also believe it's environmental. I also believe at some phase of this, when you go into a city, you need to have, I always think of it as like a technology boys and girls club. You need to have an environment where kids are comfortable to go in and feel comfortable exploring these ideas, so they're not ridiculed by their friends who don't value education, they're not talked down to their parents who don't see the importance of it, but they can be free. And I bring that from because, you know, I was lucky enough that I've always attended private school. And the thing about private school is, it's those environments that allow you to be as creative as you want to be. Like, you can just think of ideas, you have kids out talking to academics, and, you know, I also believe private schools are the biggest shakedown in the world, because you shouldn't have to pay all that money to have that. You should be able to have that in public schools. But at the same time, that is what stimulates growth and thought, right? And really, when I'm talking about technology, I'm not saying everybody should be an engineer, right? I don't code anymore, you know, but I can tell you services that you can use. And that's what I mean, the barriers are so low. There's not a problem you have, there's not a business problem you have, that there's not some service that can help you do it faster. There just isn't. And then that's how pervasive the internet is. And when you think about that, right, if I'm a small business owner or if I'm trying to start out, being able to know those services are there. An analogy I give people is there could be a florist in the inner city and a florist in the suburbs. The florist in the inner city is directly in the pathways to get high visibility, high traffic for their product. The problem is the florist in the suburbs throws up a website so they can expand and sell their product everywhere. The florist in the suburbs can take credit cards so they can take it. The florist in the suburbs is connected with online delivery, so they're delivering things there. So even though that florist is right there in the inner city, they're less convenient than the one in the suburbs. That type of thing happens every day. And that's just a sheer gap in knowledge of what the opportunities are there. And if you think about it, we create that ecosystem. I'm not expecting every college kid to be a hardcore programmer, but I'm expecting them to be savvy enough to be able to direct people to use this digital economy. It doesn't take a computer engineering degree to say, hey, stick a square in your phone and start taking credit cards. It takes literacy to understand that it's out there. You know, and that's the big thing, is that if it's a big problem, but the solutions really aren't that big. I mean, and the hardest part, because it really is a perspective shift. It's not, you know, moving a building, changing a building. It's getting someone to think differently. And the hardest problem is, when you think that way, it's foreign to you to try and figure out someone that doesn't think that way, right? I mean, think about it. Like, think about if you didn't have a smartphone. You know, if people have BlackBerries, they still don't have smartphones, but that's just my personal preference. But there are people out there who don't have that connection. I mean, think about it. You pat yourself down like you lost your donor card if you can't find your phone. Like, I mean, those are real things. Like, those are the disconnects that we have to change. And in their mind, they're oblivious to it.
Well,
absolutely. And in that case, it really became attractive to me when he said he was opening up one in Chicago, because you're absolutely right. I think, You need visual examples. You need kids saying, hey, remember John? John got a job as a computer programmer. He just drove around here in a nice car. Like, I mean, it sounds silly, but that's what people resonate to. Like, I mean, it just is. And Silicon Valley is just not, it's not that. It's not the bastion of diversity, and it never will be. And at the end of the day, I don't need it to be. Like, you know, I just need to take those things to other places, you know. And there's people trying. Like, in Detroit, Dan Gilbert, who owns Quicken Loans and the Cleveland Cavaliers, is making a big push for entrepreneurship in that city. But the problem is no one's teaching the kids what they need to know to become entrepreneurs in the first place. Like, even though my friends, they're creating those programs, but they're like three steps above the problem. Like, Tristan goes to Carnegie Mellon and University of Penn, and he finds very bright minority kids. But I argue that they're already a better place. I mean, it's great that they're in startups. Like, don't fault me. But they're not the ones I'm worried about, right? I'm worried about the kid that I talk to when I say, hey, have you looked at programming? He's looking at me like I got a hole in my chest. Like, I mean, literally, like, yeah. Those are the ones I'm worried about, because in their mind, it just doesn't even resonate. It just doesn't resonate, and that's the problem. Go ahead.
Do you have a sense that the, I say this growing up in Los Angeles, that the entertainment world is going to be, like, generating programming, gaming, where there's just a bunch of these kids on technology all the time as some kind of central, just, you know, along those lines of marketing, images people see, getting accustomed to the images, the cable people are paying for, that this would actually come into their homes visually?
I think I understand your question. Are you basically saying that are they going to create things to stimulate kids to create those things?
Show with, like, a lot of technology in it.
So unfortunately, no. And here's the problem, right? I mean, what you have to understand from a dynamics of media is that the media business is struggling right now, right? So they're going to put on whatever keeps the most people watching. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, right now, it's bottom basement television, right? I mean, I'll give you an example. When I was at BT, there was a guy, Tavis Smiley, who had a political news show, et cetera, right? So when they took it off the air, they picketed the CEO's house, et cetera. It was the lowest rated show on BET. So, like, you didn't watch it, but you argued when you took it off. And that happens all the time. Like, the most popular rated shows are the trashiest shows, because that's what people are consuming. But the problem is, we all shake our head. We're not the ones consuming them. The people who are consuming them are the same people I'm talking about, because that's what they occupy their time with. Imagine if instead of watching, you know, Hip Hop Wives or whatever, the kid was on the computer teaching themselves how to code. I mean, that's the disconnect. But in their mind, that visually represents success. I mean, think about it. And now it's worse, where they're like, hey, that person, I didn't even know that person a week ago, and now they have a reality show, and now they're famous. So that's an easier path. You know what, they've tried. I mean, there's been thoughts of it. It's just hard to get pushed because positive television doesn't sell. It's, I mean, it's the way of the world, unfortunately. You know. Go ahead.
So I like the idea of the ecosystem, that concept. And then one other statement I'll make about technology and African American. My sister, which live in Dallas, Texas, her family, you know, she's had some struggles, so she's a single mom. All of her kids have iPhones, but they don't have, you know, computers.
Right.
So is there something around the iPhone technology that might inspire African American or Hispanic kids to become more technically savvy?
Yep.
How do you then, what in your program is addressing how to get that mentality shifted in the home? Do you have focus on educating the parents or building awareness with parents? I mean, how do you influence or foster that?
Yeah, I think the mobile thing is interesting, right? Because you're right. I think what's happening in a lot of homes, specifically now with the popularity of the iPhone, is in a lot of lower income homes, they have iPhones, right? The problem is that right now there's no education. Again, there's that disconnect, right? Like, your nephews probably have 100 apps on their phone. Have they thought about what it takes to build one of those apps? Probably not, right? So, like, that's the disconnect. And that's why I show that slide about the kids, because the money is a visual representation, right? And to me, you know, speaking, you know, you guys may never realize I am African American. Speaking as an African American, we have been natural born entrepreneurs throughout our lives, right? We find ways out of no way. We just need the spark, right? So I could guarantee if I had a conversation with your nephews that they would be in the library next week on the library's computers, even the library didn't know, building iPhone apps on the library computers. Like this how we think. The problem is that there's no visual examples for them to have that spark, and it's kind of become okay. Like that's the big challenge, is that it's kind of become okay. And like I said, there's levels to it. So there's that level. And it sounds like your sister would be willing to go learn. So yes, I think for that level, there should be classes for the adults. There's some adults who don't care. So you have to give the kids an environment where it's outside of their adults. I think the other level is you have people who are in the ecosystem but don't learn the right way, which is sometimes almost worse because we don't get a lot of opportunities. And when we get opportunities, if we don't know the right way to do things, it's actually worse than not having them, because that gives people more statistical relevance of why we shouldn't be there in the first place. So, you kind of have to do it. And I'll be totally honest with you. You know, the Close the Divide project, and we talked about this morning, I spent like 2 weeks obsessing about what it should be, and then I had to kind of smack myself in the head and say, you're an internet guy. Just start doing stuff, right? So, I look at it the same way I would look at if I was starting a startup internet company. I could write you a 5-year plan, it would be crap. Just like most 5-year internet plans of internet companies are crap because they don't know what the market's gonna tell them, right? What I believe, I firmly believe that going out is gonna create change, and we're gonna do it based on need, right? If the prevalent need is whole families getting educated in that city, then that's what's gonna need to be done. If the prevalent need is creating an environment for kids to be away from their families, that's what's gonna need to be done. And I think there's tiers of it too, like I said. And this is not, I focus on minorities because they're a challenged group, but this is a global problem, right, across the United States that we need to solve. I think women have an issue too. Women of all races need this opportunity as well. So it's going to morph, to be honest with you. But the mobile piece, it is a challenge, right, because the difference between a mobile app is that you get set, a mobile phone, you get savvy with it. But you can't build on it, right? You just, there's no way to do that right now. But I would at least argue that if you showed me a kid that knew different apps, that did different things, whether they were business and personal, they're still in a better place than the kids who don't, right? So at least it builds a savviness, yes.
Yep.
This whole industry and not just use.
Yep, so I'm gonna take them in order. Tell me if I miss one. So I think the first one, you're absolutely right. There's this weird thing going on where people won't buy computers, but they'll buy smartphones. And the only explanation I can give to that is because the smartphone's a visual representation. It's an image thing. And the crazy part is, specifically there's people who have Android phones and don't even know they have Android phones, right? They have a prepaid phone from some provider, and they know it gets them on the internet. They don't even understand the concept that, hey, it's an Android phone. And now I think, I just saw last week, Walmart offers iPhones prepaid. And so you're going to, iPhones are going to be prevalent everywhere. And the first challenge with that is, like you said, they're willing to pay the minute charges, et cetera. But that's an educational thing, because quite frankly, if they brought their kids iPod touches and got internet in the home, they could do 90% of the things outside of calling them from school, which they probably don't do anyway. they could do them at home and they could save money, right? So that's an educational thing. The second thing around schools, I mean, there's a bunch of programs that get kids interested in technology. I think one's called SNAP, for lack of a better term. It's a visual programming language. I'll double check, I might have the name wrong. But there's 100 things to do. Now, your question about getting African-Americans to build applications for other African-Americans for free, I think the challenge is for free because, you know, the people who are technically savvy are trying to make a living like everyone else, so they need resources. Yeah, if someone funded a grant, I'm sure you'd probably have them lining up. But that's the challenge too, right? It's an economic challenge as well to get them to do that. I mean, there's programs out there for everyone that they can use. They don't necessarily have to be for African Americans. But I think what we need to do is educate teachers and getting more comfortable with technology too, because that's another issue too, is a lot of teachers aren't comfortable with technology. Because for example, my photo bucket example doesn't cost them any money, but at least it gets the kids like, that's cool, how do you do that? And they're like, hey, here's a new service. It, you know, it's a process. Anybody?
I just wanted to put one thing out about the evaluations. I have paper copies, but I'm thinking that this is not exactly the venue for that, so I encourage you all to do that.
No. I think some people here still use paper.
Let us know, yeah, and please fill it out. And thank you for joining us.
Yep, so I appreciate it. As parting gifts, I have copies of the CNN documentary for everybody that they can take and watch at their leisure at home as a present from Soledad herself. And she actually offered, since you guys are lucky people here, that if you have a foundation or organization, she'd be willing to come with me to your organization and do a session to talk about this project as well as talk about the documentary. So, thank you guys.
Tomorrow.